Good morning, you old Marbleites. It's good to see you. Good to see you. Nice to see you live streamers out there in live stream land. Today we're messing around in the Gospel of Mark for the next few weeks. And because tomorrow is Martin Luther King Day, we are going to talk today about Mark's treatment of the death of John, whom we call the Baptist, which he certainly was. He was not like a Baptist like we have. He was a baptizer, is what he was. But I have chosen to call it the death of John the Prophet, because that's what he was. And on this day when we remember Martin the Prophet, I thought it'd be good to take a look at those two deaths and what led up to them, and just look at those ancient times and our own time. It's funny, now you know that, because we've talked about it here, that Mark is the oldest gospel and that it's the shortest gospel, but his discussion of the death of John the Baptist is the longest of any of them. So that's funny, isn't it? How come when Mark is usually so kind of short and choppy and just the facts, ma'am, why would it be that he is so kind of ornate where this event is concerned? And I'm wondering who has a Bible here and would like to read the first part of the death of John the Baptist. That's the sixth chapter of the Gospel of Mark, beginning at the 14th verse. And you're going to read until verse 20, up to and including verse 20. How we doing? Let's hear. Okay, here we go. Here we go. Mark 6, verse 14.
To 20, right? King Herod heard of it, for Jesus' name had become known. Some said, John the baptizer has been raised from the dead. That is why these powers are at work in him. But others said, it is Elijah. And others said, it is a prophet like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard of it, he said, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised. For Herod had sent and seized John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because he had married her. For John said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. And Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to kill him, but she could not. For Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man, and kept him safe. When he heard him, he was much perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly.
Now that's just some interesting things here. Herod is interested in John, and he's interested in John because of what he says. Now, one of the things that John says is that your marriage is invalid and you need to stop it. And but he must have been saying some other things, because it says that when he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly. He was interested in what John was preaching, and we know what he was preaching. He was preaching repentance. He was preaching stop being sinners. He was baptizing people so that they could live new lives. So Herod, is, we usually see him as a kind of a cartoon villain, but he may have been more complex here. And it seems to me that Mark may think he's more complex too, because Herod doesn't want to kill John, it seems. It's his wife that makes him do that. Herodias was the wife of Herod's brother Philip, and Herod married her, and this is wrong, and so she doesn't like that. Let's keep going and read. We're going to read verses 21 through 29. Let's have another one. Okay, we're going to hear King James on this, I think. You people in live stream land, get that Bible your aunt gave you and unzip it and turn to Mark 6.
And when a convenient day has come, that Herod, on his birthday, made a supper to his lords, high captains, and chief estates of Galilee. And when the daughter of the said Herodias came in and danced, and pleased Herod and them that sat with him, the king said unto the damsel, ask of me whatsoever thou wilt, and I will give it thee. Here we go on. And he sware unto her, whatsoever thou shalt ask of me, I will give it thee unto the half of my kingdom. And she went forth and said unto her mother, what shall I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. And she came in straightway with haste unto the king and asked, saying, I will that thou give me by and by in a charger the head of John the Baptist. Here we go on. Is that it?
And the king. Let's go on.
And the king was exceedingly sorry. Yet for his oath's sake and for their sakes, which sat with him, he would not reject her. And immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded his head to be bought. And he went and beheaded him in the prison and bought his head in a charger and gave it to the damsel, and the damsel gave it to her mother. And when his disciples heard of it, they came and took up his corpse and laid it in a tomb.
Yeah, so it sounds like Herod doesn't want to do this, but he doesn't not want to do it enough apparently to offend his guests. So he goes and he thinks that's more important because I gave my word and people are watching. So he does do that, and the girl brings it on a charger, a platter. The girl is not named, is she? We know what her name is, right? Or at least what we've always been told her name is. What's her name? Salome. And there's an opera by Richard Strauss of Salome. But she's not named Salome, not in Scripture. That's one of these inventions that we have, one of those things that people make up. And in the opera, and in George Bernard Shaw's rendering of her, she is extremely seductive, and it's almost as if it were her plan. But it wasn't her plan. It was her mother's plan. In art, when she is depicted, she is often depicted as reluctant, or sometimes she's looking away. It's as if she too were a pawn in this terrible plan, assassination that has nothing to do with her. It's also interesting to me that Herod has the girl dance for his friends. Now, this is a Jewish banquet. Men and women don't eat together, right? Men eat separately, and this is still true in Orthodox Jewish circles today. You girls go to an Orthodox Jewish wedding, you're going to be sitting with the ladies, and the men are going to be sitting together. And it's going to be a great wedding, and you're going to have a great time, but you're not going to be sitting with your husband. So that's what this is like, too. The men and women don't eat together. And it is not Jewish to have a girl dancing for people, a performance like that. That would not be thought to be kosher at all. To this day, Orthodox Jews are very buttoned up. The ladies are in long skirts. They don't show you their hair. They may have hair. It may look like hair, but it's a wig. It's not their own hair. They're going to have a scarf. They're going to have a hat, but you're not going to see their hair. You're not going to see their arms. They'll have a long skirt on. So nudity is not good in that culture. And that's true of Middle Eastern cultures today. I think we talked about this once before. Remember when that horrible event at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, early in the Iraq War, when a bunch of our soldiers took pictures of prisoners in humiliating postures, many of them in the nude? Well, that was horrible. It's horrible in any culture, but it was horrible in that culture because nudity is just shameful in that part of the world, for men or women. And that was something. Oh, boy. And here, and it doesn't say she danced in the nude, but the idea that you would be looking at a woman dance like that is just not part of that culture. Might have been part of Roman culture, Might have been, yeah, definitely would have been. And so Herod, who's a Jewish king, is acting like a Roman occupier. He's doing things that a Roman king might do. For all we know, the ladies are eating with the men there. I don't know. Maybe so. And that would be unusual too. Yes, sir. Oh, we're going to get the mic to you.
So thank you for saying the complexity of Herod. And something just came to me. Now, John was saying Herod's marriage was illegal
right.
because Philip was alive. Mm-hmm. Now, Herod was king.
Right.
Herod could have killed Philip and legally married Herodias
without an issue. As a matter of fact, there's a certain strain of Jewish law that would demand that he do
right.
that.
Like, he should, like, that would have been like the Levitical law to
yeah.
do that.
Yeah.
And he didn't do that.
Yeah.
So he actually showed some compassion for his brother by letting him live, although by entering into this illegal marriage. Now, I'm not trying to paint him as a nice
right,
guy.
Right, not trying to defend him, but it's true. It's, so, yeah, yeah.
So, thank you. It just kind of came to me.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have a point? Well, that's all right. The mic's coming to you.
It just ran away from me.
Maybe I'll bring it back.
I don't
Maybe
know.
Maybe it's attached to the mic.
Well, it was sort of attached to what he was saying, and I kind of lost it, so I'll raise my hand in a little
bit. Yeah, sure, that's fine. So Herod doesn't want to do it, but he does it. So he certainly doesn't come out looking really good, but he comes out looking a little more human than he used to look, and a lot more human than his dad, who was behind the slaughter of the innocents. So, yeah, yeah. But the executioner beheads John. It is a favorite topic of Renaissance artists because it gives them a chance to depict a dead face, which is different from a live face and a challenge to them. So, you know, go home and Google Death of John the Baptist. Click on images. And you'll see many, many, many paintings of this, including some very famous ones, and all interesting, all grisly. With the if we're talking about paintings of Salome, the dancer, if you click on that, you'll see in the Renaissance that she often looks reluctant. But Aubrey Beardsley, the early 20th century painter who did the advertising work for Richard Strauss's opera of Salome, thought that Salome was definitely in on this, and very, very seductive and fearful looking, monstrous looking. So you might want to do that too. Google Salome, S-A-L-O-M-E. And you can do this afternoon while you're just staying out of the cold, and you'll get a chance to look at some good art. So certainly he kills her. And I just want to contrast. We're looking at Mark, but I want to contrast the other treatments of this. So we had this very long and involved discussion of what happened from Mark. Here's all Matthew says. When Herod Antipas, the ruler of Galilee, heard about Jesus, he said to his advisors, "This must be John the Baptist, raised from the dead. This is why he can do such miracles." For Herod had arrested and imprisoned John as a favor to his wife, Herodias, the former wife of Herod's brother Philip. John had been telling Herod, "It's against God's law for you to marry her." Herod wanted to kill John, but he was afraid of a riot because all the people believed John was a prophet. But at a birthday party for Herod, Herodias' daughter performed a dance that greatly pleased him. So he promised with a vow to give her anything she wanted. At her mother's urging, the girl said, "I want the head of John the Baptist on a tray." Then the king regretted what he had said. But because of the vow he had made in front of his guests, he issued the necessary orders. So John was beheaded in prison, and his head was brought on a tray and given to the girl, who took it to her mother. Later, John's disciples came for his body and buried it. Then they went and told Jesus what had happened. So much shorter. And here's Luke. Listen to this. Now Herod the Tetrarch heard about all that was going on, and he was perplexed, because some were saying that John had been raised from the dead, others that Elijah had appeared, and still others that one of the prophets of long ago had come back to life. But Herod said, "I beheaded John. Who is this, then, that I hear such things about?" And he tried to see him, Jesus. Very short. Luke's the one who gives us a birth narrative this long. Death of John the Baptist this long. What does this tell us? John the Baptist is very important for Mark and not as important for Luke. We know that he's important for Matthew because Matthew gives us the story of Elizabeth's pregnancy. John the Baptist is important for Matthew, but the death of John the Baptist is much sketchier in Matthew. And John, of course, the Gospel of John, nothing. He doesn't care about that. The story does not appear there. So why was he killed? Well, certainly there is this vow, this stupid vow that Herod made to do it. But there would be other reasons, wouldn't there? There would be other reasons why it was important to not have him on the scene. What's he doing? He's preaching repentance. He's preaching that the kingdom is coming. He's preaching, and people are hearing him. People are going out to him. He's by the River Jordan where he does his baptisms. But besides baptizing, he's also preaching out there and creating a stir. And if you're a Roman occupier, you don't like people who create stirs. You don't want stirs. You want quiet. For the most part, the Roman occupation of its colonies wasn't as brutal as it could have been. Wasn't as brutal as a lot of things were in those days. Pretty much if you kept your head down, you could be all right. As long as you keep your head down and pay your taxes and make it profitable for Rome to have you and don't make trouble, yeah, it'd be all right to be a Roman. A number of colonists became Roman citizens. Paul was one. He was a citizen of Rome. You might not be a citizen of Rome, but you might become one if you wanted to, and you could do that. So there was, by the standards of the day, the Roman occupation could have been worse. But for someone like John the Baptist and for the people of Israel in general, they did not feel good about that. I don't think they knew it could have been worse. They hated being under occupation, and primarily because it affected their religion, because they are monotheists. They believe in one God, and they sure don't believe that the emperor is a god. But you need, as a Roman citizen, to acknowledge the existence and authority of many gods, and in particular to do homage to the emperor who is one. A little bit after Jesus, this is going to become really crazy in the Roman Empire. I mean, we're pretty familiar with Nero. We're pretty familiar with Caligula. Some of these guys were nuts. And the idea that you might be God was appealing to them in their illness. And so some pretty awful things did happen. So there was trouble brewing in Israel, and Rome doesn't like trouble at all. This has a lot to do with what's happening to Jesus. And it's certainly what happened to John. It's one thing that you can do that's probably going to help Rome think you're a good governor or king, if you're Herod, if you can get rid of people who are making noise like this. And so he did. Tomorrow, in our own century, we commemorate not the death of Martin Luther King, but his birth. It's interesting, lots of days, for instance, in the saints' calendar, in Catholic and Episcopal circles, a saint is usually commemorated on the date of his death, because that's when he enters into heaven. April 4th was when Martin died, but we don't commemorate his death. We commemorate his birth because of what his life meant. So we commemorate him in the same way we commemorate Lincoln and Washington, but they entered into human life, not into the larger life. I want to hear something of Martin the night before he died. that night. You know, he was assassinated very early in that morning, and we'll talk a minute about where you were and how you remember it. For most of us here on the East Coast, we heard about it when we woke up, but it happened at about 1 a.m. We didn't have our radios on at 1 a.m., or maybe it was 2 or 3 in the morning, but it was very early in the morning. So we heard about it at about 8 or something, or whenever you woke up. But here's the speech he gave, just the last few words. I've been to the mountain. I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And so I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. That night, he says, I may not get there with you. That night, he says, I've looked over the mountain and I've seen the promised land. That night, he's comparing himself to Moses. Remember that Moses got a chance to see the promised land, but he didn't get a chance to go there. He died before he could go there. Martin knew when he had flown there from Atlanta, he was, you know, on a plane with several other people, and the pilot came on because there was a delay leaving the plane, and the pilot said, well, we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, so we wanted to check everything out very carefully. We had to check everybody's baggage much more carefully than we do, and of course, this is before 9/11. They didn't check us like they do now, but they did that day. So his plane was late leaving Atlanta, and he had been alerted, as he always was, to an increased level of threats on his way to Memphis. Meanwhile, James Earl Ray, who also lived in Atlanta, was driving to Memphis, was on his way in a car to Memphis with his gun. And so Martin knew, I think he always knew. It was not rocket science for Martin Luther King to know that his life was in danger. His house had been firebombed twice, I think, or maybe three times, with his wife and children in it. So he was no stranger to the fact that he was in danger all the time. And he must have long since made his peace with that. And this speech reminds us of that. And I guess I have to say, as horrible a day as that was, I am very glad to have this particular set of words, his last public words, to know that he wanted to live. He said, longevity has its place, he says in the same speech. And he liked life. He said, I want to live just like anybody else. But he could be at peace with not living because he had seen the promised land. He knew that the movement of which he was a part, and he did not view himself as the sole leader of that movement. He made another speech about the drum major impulse, instinct, and sometimes it's misunderstood as commending the drum major to be the big guy in front, but he did not, it was condemning the idea that you're a drum major. No, there's not a drum major, he says. He knew that he was one of many. And it's true that he was a leader, and he knew of his own importance, but he knew that he was not dispensable to this, and that the land was promised to us, and that he had seen it, and it was coming, and it was inevitable. And I'm glad that he had that. He was 39. Did he not seem older? Now, you know, we were young too, but golly, 39. What would he have done if he lived? I often think, what would he think now? And you often read, somebody will write an article, what would he be thinking? Oh, Lord, I don't know if he'd lived. We know a little bit because we know what his wife was thinking. He's got some children who have told us what they're thinking. But we don't know. I guess we know enough about him to know what he would have been like. But we do know that he was right about that. The land was promised, and it's coming. But would he have been surprised that we haven't gotten any farther than we've gotten? I wonder. I don't know. My guess is he would not be surprised. Because I don't think black people are surprised by much. When they behold racism, I don't think it's a shock to them. It might be a shock to white people. But I don't think black people are surprised by how deep its roots are. Not the ones I've talked to about it. And I don't think he would have been. Why was he killed? Well, one explanation would be that James Earl Ray was a terrible man and a racist. And he was both of those things. There was, and the King family came to believe, some belief that he was not alone in that crime. There certainly were reasons why a society who was locked into defending itself might have wanted him out of the way. A year before, in this very city, in this very city up at the Riverside Church, he gave an important speech. The speech was kind of a turning point in his public discourse. He, of course, had given his life to the inclusion of African-American people in American society. That's what ought to happen. And he'd gone to jail many times in support of that, and he was identified with that. So that's one thing. Let us in to your society on an equal basis. And that's one thing. But a year before he died at Riverside Church, he publicly began to question not just a society that wouldn't let us in, but the society in general on its own terms. We must rapidly begin, he says, the shift from a thing-oriented society to a people-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. Racism, materialism, and militarism, and this is in 1968, if he were alive now, materialism? Oh, please. Militarism, yeah, this is at the Vietnam War is in its height. But it's not now, and the share of our budget that goes to the military and the, oh my goodness, and the racism that continues and is so much deeper than at least white Americans thought it was. And you know, you'll meet white Americans today who will deny that the society is racist at all. So, you know, okay. But, you know, I think most of us are in another place. So he began to question the way we were as a whole. And that might have had something to do with getting him killed. We know that the FBI, and of course at this time it was under the direction of the paranoid J. Edgar Hoover still, believed him to be a communist dupe, and therefore believed that he was being pulled by Russians, or who knows what they believed. But he was viewed by some as a danger to our society, just as John the Baptist was viewed as a danger to the Roman occupier. Neither of them were dangerous. They were preaching repentance and the cleansing of sin. Both deaths resounded. Now, it's true that Christian circles in the first century were not large circles. So you're not going to read about the death of John the Baptist in any Roman historian. But you do read about it in Christian historians like these three gospel writers and others. John the Baptist was an important leader in early Christianity, and he had a following. And we know that the followers of Jesus were at some pains to connect themselves with the followers of John so that the followers of John, now that he was dead, would know that it was Jesus they should follow now, that the two of them were doing the same work. But sometimes we have heard, when we know this from Paul, a group of people say, well, we received the baptism from John, but we don't know anything about Holy Spirit. What? So there was some competition among the followers of Jesus and the followers of John. And we can hear this, and we hear it in the Gospel of John, who talks about John the Baptist and says, has John the Baptist say of Jesus, well, he must increase and I must decrease. So we are asked by the early Christian community to be at peace with the idea that John's legacy is in the community of Jesus Christ. Just as we are asked now to know that when Martin Luther King dies, it doesn't end the movement, that people have and must carry the responsibility of continuing that journey to the promised land. And if we were naive enough to think that it would be a short trip, well, we were naive. And now we know. I'm wondering where you were. This is one of those where were you moments, like when Kennedy was killed or when Robert Kennedy was killed. 1968 was an awful year. Golly day, because Robert Kennedy was killed. Martin was killed. Where were you when you heard about it? I was getting ready for school. And my parents did not have the same view of him as I had. They were more worried about him. Not in a good way. So they did not approach me about his assassination. I approached them. Where were you when you heard about this? Some of you weren't alive yet, am I right? Yeah, is that right? Wow. So for you, this is history. Uh-huh. Where were you when you heard about his death? What were you doing? Q, do you remember where you were? No, probably teaching or getting ready to go to school. Where were you?
I was a freshman at Birmingham Southern College in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, my goodness.
I do remember and was disgusted by the number of white citizens of Birmingham who celebrated.
Celebrating? Oh, wow. Where were you? Do you remember where you were?
Oh, yeah. I just moved to New York.
Let's hear this.
I just moved from New York, from Cincinnati, Ohio.
From Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm. And I had bought my children. But at the time, I had seen Dr. King personally.
Oh, really?
When he came to Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
And I attended a meeting that that he held. And so, but I wasn't surprised.
No.
No. We knew it was coming. You know it's coming. And it's sort of like when you think of the greats who are sent here, and I my belief is that people are sent here to do a specific job. It's no timing on it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of many leaders who have left this earth just after they've done something great,
yeah,
and they're young.
Yeah.
But they came to do their purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I felt.
He did what he came to do.
He did what he came to do. And he had to go. Now he's God took him home. He's,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's at rest.
Yeah. Who else remembers where you were? Jim, where were you? Hey, you live stream people, do you remember where you were when you heard about this? And you know, if it did not resound in you at the time, that might be because of where you lived and who lived with you. But this is now. And so we can talk about this now, and it can resound in you now. Jim, where were you?
I was a student at Fordham, and we had a very large anti-war and anti-racism program going on. And where I was, well, on the very next day, was in a march and a demonstration from Harlem down Riverside, down Central Park West. Mm-hmm. And the slogan was, "Who died for freedom? Martin Luther King." And that's a very emotional, what connected with me was we were, of course, involved in the anti-militarism aspect of things, and just the unity of anti-racism and against the war in Vietnam that meant a lot to us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Who else remembers where you were when you heard?
I was a freshman at South Dakota State University, and we were. It was the day when I was supposed to have a first date with somebody, and that really puts. I mean, it was such a traumatic thing, especially in the time of like James, the Vietnam War was also controversial. It was a difficult time.
It was a terrible year in so many ways.
I want to say I don't exactly remember where I was. As you say, probably I was getting ready for school. I was about 9. But the whole time frame was very confusing, tumultuous. So you had Vietnam, you had Kennedy, you had, Martin Luther King Jr., and it was just like in the air. And then I had a lot of personal things in my family, mm-hmm. my parents not getting along. So
it was just a very
confusing time, I have to say.
It was. Yeah. And remember, Vice President, Robert Kennedy was speaking. He'd had a, probably, and he was working on the primary, so he might have had a victory. I can't remember what city he was in. And it fell to him to tell the crowd that this assassination of Dr. King had happened. And there's television footage of that, and he announces it to the crowd, and the crowd screamed, just screamed. Go home and Google that. Google Robert Kennedy announces MLK's assassination, and you'll see some YouTube videos. Oh my goodness, it was something else. And he was dead not long afterwards. Who else remembers where you were? Where were you when Dr. King was assassinated?
I was in high school in a different country, South America, Argentina. And I remember that day. I remember Argentina is a very Catholic country.
Yeah.
And our school, a big school, was a very, very sad day. Everyone, all of us, children, 14, 15 years old, we felt like a brother or father or somebody very close to us has been killed. Yep. And we were very, very sad. Mm-hmm. And we experienced the shock of that assassination of a man that he wanted freedom for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Where were you? Do you remember where you were?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you had your hand up. But here's somebody who does have her hand up, a couple ladies.
I'm coming.
Remember where you were and what that was like for you? Here we go. Speak into the mic.
When I heard on the... was in a cab. I got to the church meeting, and it was going on. Someone did go up and tell the pastor, but he did not announce it till the whole meeting was over. And I wondered how he, with such an important person, how he could not tell the
congregation. How he managed to do that.
And this was not a mixed church. This is an African-American
Isn't
church.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, because, you know.
Huh.
It was probably,
I imagine many of us would not have done that, but, you know, sometimes when you're in shock.
I don't know. Knowing the character of that particular pastor, I I don't want to say much about him.
Yeah.
I don't really I don't remember where I was at the time that I heard. I know I was in high school, but what I do remember is my childhood friends, who I'm still blessed to have, discussing whether the doctrine of Dr. Martin Luther King versus the doctrine of Malcolm X was the way that we should turn. And I do remember us not discussing this in front of our parents, because our parents were from the South, and they accepted the doctrine of Dr. Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X was seen as sort of an outcast.
Oh, remember at the time, he seemed so scary.
And it was so radical.
Yes.
But at high school at that time, we were trying to figure out.
Sure.
With the Black Panther movement coming in.
Yep.
Which way we want to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just very difficult at that time for us to figure out which doctrine to accept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do remember that. And you all may remember how scary Malcolm seemed. And, you know, it's not going to be long before he's gone. And, you know, there are those who think that, because he was not scary. He was liberating. But liberation feels scary. There was a psychological experiment. You know, there's an animal in a cage, and so used to being in the cage that when you leave the door open, he won't go. It was this experiment, I think, about depression, and they used lab animals. So the animal's in there, and the cage is locked. But when they open up the cage door, the animal stays in the cage because it doesn't know you can get out. Maybe it's scared to get out. Yes.
Malcolm and Martin, and I kind of put all of their deaths together.
Yeah.
And Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I cried more for Kennedy. And I think the reason is because I thought with all these people who had so much hope, my country was falling apart.
Yeah.
As a person for whom this is history.
It's all history, yeah.
This is so valuable to hear the sort of power in the moment. So
and
the
I
value.
Also remember thinking, you know, when the three of them were gone, I thought, well, you know, these were white and black people who had a different vision of the world than those who killed them. And it made you afraid that vision would not prevail. But Martin was not afraid that it would not prevail. Mm-hmm. And his own death did not make him question that. So this is helpful for us, because what does it mean to triumph? What does it mean to be successful? What does it mean that mine eyes have seen the coming of the Lord? Does it mean that I'm going to win later this afternoon? Maybe not. But does it mean that God is in charge, and as he said in another speech, that the arc of history is long, but it does bend toward justice? This he believed, and this I think we still believe. And so he says, I'm happy tonight. And a large part of him seemed to know that he was about to die. If not that night, by that hand, some other hand, who knows? So, oh my goodness, live stream land and the old Marbleites. Let's sing our way out of this very briefly. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, I do believe that we shall overcome someday. God bless y'all. See you next week. We're going to talk about miracles in Mark. Later this afternoon in Marble, we got a gospel concert that's going to knock your socks off at 3 o'clock, but you got to be in New York to go to it because it's not live streamed.